the beasts. In the rear of all the legions marched the bulk of the mercenaries, followed by a protective rear guard of light and heavy infantry with a strong body of cavalry. Marching in this way, Vespasian arrived with his army at the frontiers of Galilee. There he pitched his camp, and restraining his soldiers' ardor for battle, he made a show of force to inspire terror in the enemy, and give them time for second thoughts, in the hope that before battle was joined they would change their minds. At the same time he got ready to besiege their strongholds. The sight of the commander-in-chief did indeed lead to second thoughts in many, and to terror in them all. The troops of Josephus, who were in camp not far from Sepphoris, seeing the war approaching and the Romans on the point of swooping upon them, did not wait for a battle, but even before seeing their opponents, fled in all directions. Left behind with a handful of men, Josephus saw that he had not a force capable of stopping the enemy, that the morale of the Jews had collapsed, and that if they could get the Romans to trust them, the majority would be only too pleased to ask for terms. He already saw disaster looming ahead, but for the time being he decided to keep as far away as possible from danger, and with those who had stuck to him sought shelter in Tiberias. Vespasian descended on Gabara, and finding it almost without defenders, took it at the first assault. He marched into the town and put to the sword all except small children. The Romans, showing mercy to neither young nor old, through hatred of the nation and the memory of the way they had treated Cestius. He burnt down not only the town itself, but all the hamlets and villages around. Some of these he found completely abandoned. From others he carried off all the occupants as slaves. Josephus, by his hurried arrival, produced panic in the city he had chosen as a refuge. The people of Tiberias concluded that if he had not completely written off the war, he would never have taken to flight. In this they were perfectly right about his opinion, for he saw the inevitable end awaiting the Jews and knew that their one safety lay in a change of heart. He himself, he felt sure, would be pardoned if he went over to the Romans, but he would rather have died over and over again than betray his motherland and flout the trust reposed in him in order to make himself at home with those he had been sent to fight. So he determined to write for the Jerusalem authorities a detailed appreciation of the situation, without either exaggerating the strength of the enemy, and so later finding himself abused as a coward, or minimizing it, and thereby reviving their hopes just when they were having second thoughts. He suggested that if they were ready to sue for terms, they should write back at once. If they were determined to fight the Romans, they must send him adequate forces. Having set down these proposals, he dispatched the letter to Jerusalem by express messengers. Vespasian was eager to destroy Jotapata, for he was informed that the biggest number of the enemy had taken refuge there, and that, in addition, it was a strong base for their activities. He therefore sent infantry and cavalry ahead to level the road, which was stony mountain track, difficult for infantry, and for cavalry quite impossible. They took only 4 days to complete their task, opening a broad highway for the army. On the 15th day, the 21st of Artemisius, Josephus left Tiberias and slipped into Jotapata in time, awakening new courage in the sinking hearts of the Jews. Vespasian heard the good news of his arrival from a deserter, who urged him to attack the city with all speed, for when it submitted, all Judea would submit, provided Josephus fell into his hands. Vespasian seized on this news as a most marvelous piece of luck. It must be by divine providence that the man who was considered the most able of his enemies had put his own head in the noose. Without losing a moment, he sent 1,000 horsemen under Placidus and the decurion Ebutius, a man with a reputation for energy and ability, with orders to put a ring round the town and prevent the secret escape of Josephus. Next day the general himself followed with his entire force, and after marching till dusk arrived before Jotapata. He led the army to the north of the town and pitched his camp on rising ground 3/4 of a mile from the walls, trying to make himself as conspicuous as possible in order to demoralize the enemy. The effect was immediate, and so overwhelmed the Jews that no one dared to go outside the walls. The Romans did not feel inclined to make their onslaught at once, after marching all day, but they put a double line of infantry round the town, stationing a third line outside them, formed from the cavalry, so blocking all the enemy's means of egress. Thus robbed of all hope of escape, the Jews were stimulated to deeds of daring. For in war there is nothing like necessity to rouse the fighting spirit. Next morning the assault began. At first the Jews stood their ground, remaining where they were encamped before the wall opposite the Romans. So Vespasian brought up against them his bowmen and slingers and all who were equipped with long-range weapons, with instructions to keep up a barrage, while he himself with the infantry pushed up the slope where the wall was easy to surmount. Then Josephus, seeing disaster threaten the city, made a vigorous sortie at the head of the whole Jewish garrison. Falling in a body on the Romans, they drove them back from the wall, performing many remarkable deeds of prowess and daring. However, the enemy's losses were equaled by their own. The Jews were spurred on by the hopelessness of their situation, the Romans just as effectively by a sense of shame. One side was armed with experience as well as prowess, the other had no weapon but animal courage, no captain but blind fury. All day long they were locked in battle till night parted them. Roman casualties were very heavy, and included 13 killed. On the Jewish side, the dead numbered 17, and the wounded 600. On the next day, the Romans attacked again. Then the Jews, sallying out against them, met their advance with greatly increased determination, emboldened by their surprisingly effective resistance on the previous day. But they found the Romans, too, more aggressive than before, for shame put them into a blazing passion, and they considered a failure to win quickly equivalent to a defeat. For 5 days the Roman attacks were incessant, and the sallies of the defenders and their fighting on the walls grew more and more determined. The Jews were not dismayed by the strength of the enemy, nor the Romans put off by the difficulty of capturing the town. Jotapata is almost entirely perched on a precipice, cut off on 3 sides by ravines of such extraordinary depth that when people look down into them, their sight cannot reach the bottom. The only access is from the north, where the town is built up to the lowest slope of the mountain. This slope Josephus had included when he built the walls, so that the enemy could not occupy the ridge which commanded the town. This, a ring of heights screened so effectively that until a man was actually inside, it could not be seen at all. Such were the bastions of Jotapata. Vespasian was not going to be defeated either by the natural strength of the place or by the daring resistance of the Jews. He determined to prosecute the siege more vigorously and called a meeting of senior officers to plan the assault. It was resolved to build a platform against the approachable section of the wall, so Vespasian sent out the whole army to collect material. The heights round the town were stripped of their trees, and along with the timber a mountain of stones was piled up. Then, as a shelter from missiles descending from above, a second party erected a line of hurdles, supported by uprights, and constructed the platform under their shelter, the bombardment from the walls causing few, if any, casualties. A third party tore up the hillocks nearby and kept up a constant supply of earth to the builders. Thus, with the men working in 3 groups, nobody was idle. Meanwhile, the Jews launched great rocks from the walls onto the enemy's screens, together with every kind of missile. Even when they failed to reach their mark, the noise was frightful and hindered the work. Vespasian next set up his projectile throwers in a ring, 160 engines in all, and gave instructions to bombard the man on the wall. In a synchronized barrage, the catapults shot lances into the air, and stones weighing nearly 100 weight were discharged from stone throwers, together with firebrands and a dense shower of arrows, driving the Jews not only from the wall, but also from the area inside traversed by the missiles. For a host of Arab bowmen with the javelin man and slingers let fly at the same time as the artillery. The defenders, however, though unable to retaliate from the ramparts, were by no means idle. They made swift sallies in company strength, guerrilla fashion, tore away the screens that sheltered the working party, and assailed them in their unprotected state. And whenever the Romans retired, they broke up the platform and set light to the uprights and hurdles. This continued till Vespasian realized that the lack of continuity in the earthworks was the cause of the trouble, since the gaps provided the Jews with an avenue of attack. He then linked the screens together and at the same time concentrated his forces, bringing an end to the Jewish penetrations. As the platform was now rising and had almost reached the battlements, Josephus, thinking it disgraceful if he failed to invent some counter-device to save the town, collected stonemasons and instructed them to raise the wall higher. When they declared that it was impossible to build under such a hail of missiles, he devised protection for them as follows. He ordered the men to fix railings to the wall, and over these to stretch raw ox hides, so that when the stones hurled by the engines fell on them, they would give without splitting. Other types of missiles would glance off them, and firebrands would be quenched by their moisture. Thus protected, the builders worked in safety, day and night. They raised the wall to a height of 30 feet, built towers on it at short intervals, and completed it with a stout parapet. At this, the Romans, who had fancied themselves already inside the town, were plunged into despondency. The resourcefulness of Josephus and the determination of the defenders amazed them. Vespasian was exasperated both by the cleverness of the stratagem and by the fearlessness of the townsmen, who, encouraged by the new fortifications, resumed their night sorties against the Romans, and in the daytime engaged them at company strength. Every device of guerrilla war was brought into play. Everything in their path was plundered, and the rest of the besiegers' works were set on fire. At length, Vespasian recalled his troops from the battle and determined to blockade the town till starvation forced it to surrender. For the defenders would either be compelled by lack of provisions to beg for mercy, or if they held out to the bitter end, would die of starvation. He was confident that he would overwhelm them much more easily on the battlefield if he waited a while and made a fresh onslaught when they were exhausted. He therefore ordered watch to be kept on the sally ports. Inside, there was plenty of corn and all other necessaries except salt, but the water supply was inadequate, as there was no spring within the walls and the townsfolk depended on rainwater, and little or no rain falls in the district during summer. As it was at that season that the siege took place, they were terribly despondent at the prospect of having nothing to drink, and fretting already as if the water supply had failed completely. For Josephus, seeing that the town had all other necessaries in abundance and that morale was high, and wishing to pin down the besiegers longer than they expected, had rationed his men's drink from the beginning. They, however, found this husbanding of resources harder to bear than actual shortage. Unable to please themselves, they felt the craving the more acutely, and as if they had already reached the last degree of thirst, they began to flag. Their condition could not be hidden from the Romans. From the rising ground they looked over the wall and saw the Jews collecting in one spot to receive their water ration. So they made this spot the target for their quick-loaders, causing very heavy losses. Vespasian hoped that before long the tanks would be empty, and the surrender of the town would inevitably follow. But Josephus, determined to shatter this hope, ordered numbers of men to soak their outer garments and hang them round the battlements, so that the whole wall suddenly ran with water. The result was despondency and consternation in the Roman ranks when they saw such a quantity of water thrown away in jest by men who were thought to have nothing to drink. The commander-in-chief himself despaired of capturing the town through shortage, then reverted to armed onslaught. Nothing could have pleased the Jews better, for they had long despaired of saving the town or themselves, and dreaded hunger and thirst far more than death in battle. Josephus, however, devised a second stratagem to obtain more supplies than he needed. Down a gully, well nigh impassable, and consequently overlooked by the Roman guards, and along the western portion of the valley, he sent out messengers who delivered letters to Jews outside with whom he wished to make contact, and brought back their answers, together with ample supplies of all necessaries that the town lacked. The messengers were instructed to crawl past the guard posts as a rule, and to cover their backs with sheepskin, so that if anyone did see them in the night, they would be mistaken for dogs. But after a while, the pickets detected the device and blocked the gully. This concludes Volume 1 of The Jewish War by Josephus. Volume 2 resumes the tragic story of the destruction of Jerusalem as we see Josephus himself taken prisoner by the Romans. The Roman general, Vespasian, continues his advance on Jerusalem in the midst of widespread destruction in the countryside. Meanwhile, in Jerusalem itself, rival factions have turned the once beautiful city into a nightmare of seething conflict. Civil war rages in the streets of Jerusalem even as the Roman military machine approaches. In some of the most harrowing language ever committed to paper, Josephus describes the inhuman conditions in the city as the suicidal zealots doom any chances of survival for the Jewish residents. You will learn how Vespasian becomes emperor, turning over the command of the armies to his son Titus, how Titus tightens the noose around Jerusalem, and how his determined troops finally break into the city and grapple with its valiant defenders. The horrors of the siege, the unforgettable description of the burning of the great temple, and the brutal subjugation of the revolt are vividly brought to life in Volume 2 of The Jewish War, an incredible drama of the final days of ancient Jerusalem.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.